good advice for me.
These old folk tales, used in every which way, our ancestors gave us a great gift, a real gift, when they gave us these oral stories. We haven't appreciated them in the last 100 years or so, but these are amazing stories. First of all, they come from careful living in specific place. A story from India has in it India. A story from Afghanistan has Afghanistan. A story from England has England. A story from France or Germany, China, Japan, they're all different. A Sicilian story is not the same as an Irish, and yet it has something similar. That way of being human in this world. You're listening to Told and Retold. I'm Gioia Timpanelli. Winter was the sacred seasons for our ancestors, the solstices. The winter solstice comes from Latin sol sistere, sistere, to make stand, the sol, to make the sun stand still. The winter solstice around December 22nd is when the sun is farthest from the equator and appears to pause before returning. Solstice is the apparent standing still of the sun, a sacred time. In my family and in my neighborhood, where there were lots of different people celebrating different feasts, we particularly had the feast of the Roman Saturnalia in our background. And although we were celebrating Christmas, the Saturnalia hung on in certain ways, the Roman feast of Saturn and Ops. It was meant to be a topsy-turvy world where things were beginning and ending and where all people and occupations were exchanging places. It was the time in the Roman year where you could actually play cards, gamble, and that was something that we did. We always played a little game of chance. So this is a time for feasting that's happening in the outer world, and it's wonderful. The families and friends were all meeting and cheering and doing all kinds of things with each other, celebrating. But it's also a time for going underground, waiting, like a stone or a seed. Sometimes, in this case, sometimes humans are doing one thing and another thing is happening, and that thing is a sort of testing of the soul. It is told and retold, once upon a time, there was a boy, a poor boy, who was asked to go out in the snow to gather some pieces of wood, to gather some little windfalls if he could find them for the fire. It was cold. It had been snowing all night. And the boy went out, the poor boy went out. He had no gloves. He had barely a jacket. And it was very bitter out there. And he went out to find some wood for the fire. And you know, it's wonderful when you know that there are windfalls and you can easily pick up pieces of wood, that boughs that have fallen, little branches, twigs. And you really are fortunate. But since it had snowed, there was no such luck for this kid. So he goes out and looks and looks, and finally he sees a broken branch of a tree, and he starts digging in the snow because there's a little piece of wood sticking up, and his hands are, they're really hurting because it's icy, and he digs and digs, and he goes deeper and deeper, and finally he finds that branch, he picks it up, he's able to cut little twigs from it and cut it up and make a little pile of kindling, and he's ready to go back home with his duty accomplished, and all of a sudden he sees something shining in the frozen snow. And he looks and he thinks he's seeing something gold. And he digs down a little bit more, and sure enough, it's a golden box, a small and beautiful golden box. Well, he tries to lift the lid because, after all, who knows what's in that treasure box? But it's locked. The little box is locked, and he thinks, well, if the box is here, surely the key will be somewhere nearby. So he looks around. He doesn't find it. He digs some more, and it's really exciting, and he digs, and down in the frozen snow, he finds a tiny key. Takes the key, puts it in the lock, and turns it. And it doesn't catch, so he turns it again. And oh no, it doesn't catch. He turns it again and again. Now, you know how those are. Every once in a while, you come upon a lock and a key that turn round and round and round, and they just don't click. They just don't open. Well, our story ends here. We don't know what's in that box. What do you think? Well, the old folk tales, they're so smart. They're so smart. What's in the box? Well, we have to provide that. Because what is missing at the beginning is gained at the end. And often the gifts, friend, often the gifts, neighbors, are not about material things.
Them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
You're listening to Told and Retold. I'm Joya Timpanelli. The next piece is from Eric Darton's Notes of a New York Sun.
Who knows why, but on your way toward Le Gamin, you flash back to once upon a time, got to be at least 4 years ago, when you went by the café, more or less in the same graying, soon-to-fade light, to clear your head and have a coffee before going back to work on the book. As you approached down the street, you saw a man standing outside staring through the window in a manner you imagined wistful. "How long has this place been here?" he asked. You told him and he nodded. He used to live in the neighborhood, remembered the mom-and-pop store that came before. "And where does he live now?" you asked. "I'm homeless," he said. "I live everywhere." Standing there, you fell into a conversation, and before long he reached into his pocket, pulled out a small piece of black paper and a tiny scissors, and began cutting, pausing every now and then to look up at you. It took a while for you to realize that he was forming a miniature portrait in silhouette. "Contact paper," he responded to your unasked question. When he finished, he asked if you had a piece of paper. You pulled one of the manuscript pages from the book out of your bag, and carefully he peeled the backing off and adhered your image to the blank side of the page, pressing with his thumb against his palm. Handed it to you. Extraordinary. A fair likeness, and so finely wrought. "I'd love to give you something for this," you said, "but I've hardly anything on me." He cocked his head to one side and looked at you squarely, almost accusingly. "What's the matter? Can't you accept a blessing?" In truth, not really. Not in the moment. Just stood there calculating what was in your pocket. "I can stand you to a cup of coffee." "Sure," he said. And thus continued the conversation inside, until, in an hour or so, you went your separate ways.
Broken gates, broken dishes, broken pots, streets are filled. hearts. Broken words never meant to be spoken. Everything is broken.
You're listening to Told and Retold. I'm Joya Timpanelli. In my neck of the woods, winter has got plenty of snow, at least it used to. And if we humans don't watch out, we're going to really find ourselves not only in global warming, but in worse trouble than that. Well, that's pretty bad trouble. Anyway, in my neck of the woods, winter is snow. And winter, all the creatures stay close to home. The chickadees don't go out into the fields where there's a hard wind catching them, or if they're wet, getting frozen, because that means the end. There are other creatures who can't, like wild turkey, can't run across the snow if it's deep, deep, deep. And they have to do one of those running, and falling in and doing the best they can to make a space for themselves so they can get up on top of the snow and run again. The deer are always out there looking for the next bite, the next little bit of tree or what they can find. And the bobcat. Now, you know, I've been looking for I'm a bird watcher, so I've been looking at birds and things all my life practically. And I've seen a number of bobcats along the way. And I saw one trying to get a deer, one I knew quite well, who passes by the house in the late afternoon, sometimes with a group, sometimes alone, depending upon the season. I heard the deer huffing and danger. It was saying, huff, huff. It was saying, get away, get away. And I looked, and there was his cat. I thought, oh, this is a cat. And then I looked, of course, it was a bobcat, a very large cat. And it was having a standoff with this deer, and it was quite an amazing thing to see. But finally, I moved something, and the cat heard it and went off, and the beautiful body just went over a stone wall, and its little short tail went. And I said, oh, bobcat, yeah, bobcat. You're listening to Told and Retold. I'm Joya Timpanelli. This is From Under the Greenwood Tree by Thomas Hardy, that old great nature lover. Mellstock Lane. To dwellers in a wood, almost every species of tree has its voice, as well as its feature. At the passing of the breeze, the fir trees sob and moan no less distinctly than they rock. The holly whistles as it battles with itself. The ash hisses amid its quiverings. The beech rustles while its flat boughs rise and fall. And winter, which modifies the note of such trees as shed their leaves, does not destroy its individuality. On a cold and starry Christmas Eve within living memory, a man was passing up towards Mellstock Cross in the darkness of a plantation that whispered thus distinctively to his intelligence. All the evidences of his nature were those afforded by the spirit of his footsteps, which succeeded each other lightly and quickly, and by the liveliness of his voice as he sang in a rural cadence.
With the rose and the lily and the daffodowndilly, the lads and the lasses a sheep shearing go. Sight for sore eyes, it's a long time no see. Working hard, hardly working, hey man, you know me. Water under the bridge, did you see my new car? Well, it's bought and it's paid for, parked outside of the bar. And they bark. Keeping you, keep.
news. Hey, you know what I think? That we toast to the old days and DiMaggio too. And old Drysdale and Malibu, Whitey Ford and two.
You're listening to Told and Retold. I'm Joya Timpanelli. I'm lucky to call Kate Barnes my friend. Her voice is unique. It is the voice that is full of courtesy, of understanding, of something old and something absolutely contemporary.
At home. My mother, that feast of light, has always sat down, composed herself, and written poetry, hardly reworking any, just the way she used to tell us that Chinese painters painted. First they sat for days on the hillside watching the rabbits. Then they went home. They set out ink and paper, meditated, and only then picked up their brushes to catch the lift of a rabbit in mid-hop. If it didn't come out, I would throw it away. Oh, she is still a bird that fills a bush with singing. The way that she touches her teacup, the look she gives you as you sit across from her, it is all a kind of essential music. I also remember my father, alone at the dining room table, the ink bottle safe in a bowl, his orange-red fountain pen in his big hand. The hand moved slowly back and forth, and the floor below was white with sheets of paper, each carrying a rejected phrase or two, as he struggled all morning to finish just one sentence, like a smith hammering thick and glowing iron, like Jacob wrestling with the astonishing angel.
That was Kate Barnes, Poet Laureate of Maine, incredible poet about nature, about life, about stories. You're listening to Told and Retold. I'm Joya Timpanelli. These ordinary stories, these little folk tales, are about our living, our passing, our mortality. They speak extemporaneously from the moment, from personal experience and understanding. They speak about error and mistake, also about windfalls picked up after a storm. These ordinary stories are good, bad, or indifferent teachers, uncommon treasure boxes of the human mind and mirrors of its soulful life. The old folktales especially have a sneaky logic found in poetry, metaphor, and dreams. We can be thankful that they're not given to large statements on meaning, for like the heart, to whom they constantly speak, they prefer experience to discussions, unity to separation. Everything in them has weight, even a feather blowing here and there. They live in the particular while trying to talk politely about everybody. Full of lively images, these old tales carry with them the magic of the created world. Although humble, they hold the possibility of experiencing the miracle of an ordinary day. Ryokan, a Zen master, lived in a very simple way. He had a small hut with hardly anything in it. It was at the foot of a mountain. And one evening, when he was going home, going up to his little hut, he saw that he had been visited by a thief. A man was inside rummaging around, but the thief, poor thing, didn't find anything because Ryokan didn't have anything. "Well," said the Zen master as he came in, "I'm sorry. You've come a long way to visit me, and I don't have anything to give you." At which point the monk then just took off his clothes and gave it to the thief, who was absolutely startled. He took the clothes and bowed and ran off. Well, there was Ryokan naked. He went outside. He looked up at the moon. "Ah," he said, "poor man. I wish I could give him this beautiful moon." You're listening to Told and Retold. I'm Gioia Timpanelli, and next I'll be speaking with my old friend, the poet Robert Bly. You're listening to Told and Retold. I'm Gioia Timpanelli. Next, I'm going to share with you a conversation I had with a very dear friend of mine, Robert Bly. Robert and I went around the country and England and a number of other places reciting and telling stories and poems. He read those beautiful poems, his and translations, and all those wonderful comments about writing and metaphor, and we joined together to, I don't know, we thought we were helping to bring back something of the oral tradition that we believed was important, because when a country's lost its ear, its ear to hear the image, to hear and then revision the image, to understand metaphor, to get back into the metaphor, to leave the world of just only commerce and fact, well, what you have is the possibility of a rich life, of a real life. You have the possibility of real work and real love. Robert and I did that for a number of years, and this is a conversation we had recently about stories and about his poems. Here we are, December. Robert, your birthday, the 23rd, huh?
Yes.
What's it like to have a birthday in December, Robert?
I enjoy it. It's connected with Christmas.
So your birthday's the 23rd. I love celebrating your birthday so close to Christmas, too. I know the whole family likes getting together around that time. It's like presents and gifts in abundance. Your poems are a great gift, Robert. Would you read us Snowbanks?
Yeah. I was living in a farm in Minnesota at the time, and after a huge snowstorm, I went out the back of the house, and to my surprise, there was no snow at all for 3 feet or so, because the snow comes and hits the house and decides to go around it. So I thought I'll begin with this line, "Those great sweeps of snow that stop suddenly 6 feet from the house. Thoughts that go so far. The boy gets out of high school and reads no more books. The son stops calling home. The mother puts down her rolling pin and makes no more bread. And the wife looks at her husband one night at a party and loves him no more. The energy leaves the wine and the minister falls leaving the church. It will not come closer. The one inside moves back, and the hands touch nothing, and are safe. And the father grieves for his son, and will not leave the room where the coffin stands. He turns away from his wife, and she sleeps alone. And the sea lifts and falls all night. The moon goes on through the unattached heavens alone. And the toe of the shoe pivots in the dust. And the man in the black coat turns and goes back down the hill. No one knows why he came or why he turned away and did not climb the hill."
Hmm. the man in the black coat turns. I know everybody's asked you, who is that man?
I say, having the biggest idea.
Right. What is that about poetry? Because story, you see, story makes you say, you don't have to say exactly who the person is, but in the story, it's so economical that you can't bring in the man in the black coat without finding out something. For later on, something's going to happen. But a poem, what luck! You can bring the man in the black coat in and you can say, who is it?
Well, it's odd in a poem because, in a way, the voice or the soul decides what's going to come next without asking you, your opinion. Mm-hmm. So the father grieves for his son. That's Lincoln grieving for his son. The father grieves for his son and will not leave the room where the coffin stands. He turns away from his wife and she sleeps alone. The sea lifts and falls all night, and the moon goes on through the unattached heavens alone. Suddenly I saw a shoe. The toe of the shoe pivots in the dust. And the man in the black coat, I'm not sure who that is.
Mm-hmm.
I was wearing a black coat at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's me. And the man in the black coat turns and goes back down the hill. No one knows why he came or why he turned away and did not climb the hill.
There's something wonderful in another poem you wrote, that eternities are near. And there's a feeling in this poem that all these moments, all these important things in our lives, there's something else happening at all times. And you're saying it's the soul, too. In Light Around the Body, you have a wonderful poem called Conversation with the Soul. Do you mind reading that?
The soul said, give me something to look at. So I gave her a farm. She said, it's too large. So I gave her a field. The two of us sat down. Sometimes I would fall in love with a lake or a pine cone, but I liked her most. She knew it. Keep writing, she said. So I did. Each time the new snow fell, we would be married again. The holy dead sat down by our bed. This went on for years. Ah, this field is getting too small, she said. Don't you know anyone else to fall in love with? What would you have said to her? That's very funny.
That's wonderful.
I haven't read it for years.
You haven't?
No.
I love that.
Very, very strange.
It's strange, you say?
Yeah, it's strange.
What do you find strange? Where?
Well, it goes on and says, each time the new snow fell, we would be married again. That's right. You know, in when snow is falling, you often feel close to your soul. So you get married again. The holy dead sat down by our bed. This went on for years. This field is getting too small, she said. Don't you know anyone else to fall in love with? What would you have said to her?
Right.
I didn't know what to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, the soul, you know, we're never tired of a field of snow, but the soul has higher standards. Well, I think when the snow comes, especially if you're living in the country instead of the city, then you feel as if you're forgiven somehow. All the things you did in the summer are getting, you know, covered by the snow anyway. So there's a feeling of being given a gift by the snow. And maybe the gift is to become closer to your soul, as opposed to coming closer to your intelligence or your family or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it feels to me. That's why I love snow when it begins to fall.
What about one source of bad information? That's from Morning Poems. That's right there.
Well, with this book called Morning Poems, I took up the challenge to write a poem every morning. So that's interesting because, you know, you try to write in your best moments, and so the poem will be good. But if you have to write one every morning, you never know what your mood is. One source of bad information. There's a boy in you about 3 years old who hasn't learned a thing for 30,000 years. Sometimes it's a girl. This child had to make up its mind how to save you from death. He said things like, stay home, avoid elevators, eat only elk. You live with this child, but you don't know it. You're in the office, yes, but live with this boy at night. He's uninformed, but he does want to save your life. And he has. because of this boy, you survived a lot. He's got 6 big ideas. 5 don't work. Right now, he's repeating them to you.
That's a funny poem, and it's also very brave. Very brave.
I haven't read it for years. It's very funny.
What do you think, coming upon it again?
Very charming. I don't know. But it's really true that...
It's psychologically really on the button.
That there's something... this isn't your soul. I don't know who this is.
No.
But it's some being inside that is very, very old and hasn't noticed that we're no longer living in caves. You know, it just escaped this boy. And so you can't put much on the advice he gives you, but you have to be grateful that he wants you to stay alive. So he says, eat only elk.
Right. but it is the first thing. It's like that first place where you say, survive, survive.
Right.
And this is the kid
that
keeps saying, survive, survive. We're going to make it. We're going to make it. It's okay.
But so you have to love him, you know. You really have to love him.
But you don't have to listen to that advice.
No.
And the times it's interfering with a lot of other people or other things in your life, you've got to say, wait a minute.
Right. I'm married. Don't you know that?
Yeah, listen, I don't need to eat elk tonight. It's
yeah,
all right. A poem called People Like Us. It's in Morning Poems. It's right there. That poem you dedicate, well, I'd love to hear you read it.
People Like Us.
Right there. Here it is.
Yeah.
People Like Us.
Well, this is dedicated to James Wright. And Jim got a Fulbright to go to Europe, and he was supposed to go and find some professor and work with him. But he always got confused and went to the wrong building and all of that sort of thing. And finally, he got in the wrong classroom one day, and he saw an Italian man, Professor Susini, who was talking about the Austrian poet Georg Trakl.
Oh.
And Jim had never heard of Trakl. And so that changed his whole life.
Whoa.
So I thought, well, it's sometimes good not to be able to know where you're going. People like us. There are more like us. All over the world there are confused people who can't remember the name of their dog when they wake up, and people who love God but can't remember where he was when they went to sleep. It's all right. The world cleanses itself this way. A wrong number occurs to you in the middle of the night. You dial it. It rings just in time to save the house. And the second story man gets the wrong address where the insomniac lives, and he's lonely, and they talk, and the thief goes back to college. Even in graduate school, you can wander into the wrong classroom and hear great poems lovingly spoken by the wrong professor, and you find your soul, and greatness has a defender, and even in death, you're safe.
The business of, you call it, confused, we're confused. Isn't it that we're not part of that world that goes on one stop after the other, the part of us that says, we've got the right way to do it. I mean, it can't be this cockamamie way. It can't be this way that just whatever comes before us, we pick up. But it's really true that art depends on that. Somehow, a lot of things in our life depend on that because we're writing poems or telling stories. A shoemaker and his wife, through absolutely no fault of their own, became so poor that they only had enough leather for a single pair of shoes. The poor shoemaker, that's all he had. So that evening he cut the pattern, he cut out the shoe pattern, and he thought, okay, so tomorrow morning I'll work on this last possible pair of shoes. And he cuts them and he leaves them on his bench. And he and his wife go inside, and she's made them some nice soup, and it's cold, kind of miserable out. They sit down, they say their prayers, they have their soup, and they talk for a little bit, and after that, they go to bed, they bring the candle in with them, they say their prayers, blow the candle out, and go to sleep. And they go to sleep. Fast asleep, for they have nothing on their conscience. They're not worried about anything except, unfortunately, that last pair of shoes. Now, in the morning, he got up, said his prayers, had his little bit of hot milk, and went into his little workroom. And he was about to sit down when all of a sudden he sees on the workbench a pair of shoes lying there. They are the most beautiful shoes he's ever seen. They are made by some master craftsman. Who could it be? The stitches so small. Who could have learned how to do such a thing? Now, our shoemaker was a good shoemaker, a good, honest man, but he couldn't make shoes like this. Well, he was astonished, astonished. He showed his wife. They were so excited by the beauty of those shoes. Well, that day, someone comes into the shop. Can you hear the little bells tingling? And someone comes in and sees the shoes and says, oh, these are beautiful. These are really seriously beautiful. And they buy them. And they buy them and give the shoemaker a little extra money. Now, that night, the shoemaker, with the extra money, he's bought some more leather. He cuts out two pairs of shoes. He puts them on the bench. His wife says, come, come. She's bought a little bit of soup meat, and they're now having a nice hearty soup, and they eat. They say their prayers. He commends himself to God, and she herself does too, and they go to sleep that night. And they go to sleep, a peaceful sleep they have. And in the morning, he rushes into his workbench. And there are the most beautiful pairs of shoes he's ever seen. Elegant, beautifully made. He cannot believe the stitches. He could not believe it. And he showed it to his wife, and she said, oh, they are fine indeed. Now that day, people came and bought the pairs of shoes and gave him a little extra. And so it went on, and so it went on. And the shoemaker and his wife, they were very comfortable now, for each night he cut out another pair. I don't know if it's 2, 4, 8, 16, or how many, but he cut out more leather for patterns, and then the shoes would appear. Now, this went on for some time, and the shoemaker and his wife had nothing more to worry about, and the two of them were quite happy, except it was Christmas and time for gift-giving, except it was Christmas and time to think of others, except it was Christmas and time to think about who was it who was making those shoes. And so the wife said to her husband, husband, let us wait up tonight. He said, a fine idea. So behind the curtain, the two of them waited. They blew out the candle and waited. And waited and waited. At midnight, two little naked men came through the window, opening it, closing it, setting about to the bench, and they set about their work immediately. They took out their little hammers, they took out their needle and thread, and they start making shoes and boots. They tapped, 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 and they sewed, 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 and they tapped, 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 and they sewed, 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 and they worked all night long, never stopping for a minute, until the most beautiful pairs of boots, the most beautiful pairs of shoes stood before them. And the two little men went out through the window again, closing it ever so lightly, and disappeared. Oh, oh, we have been visited, said the husband. We have been visited, said the wife. Now today, she said, I propose we go out and buy some thread and some more needles and some beautiful cloth for those two little naked fellows. Let us make them shirts. Let us make them trousers. Let us make them cravats. Let us make them little hats. And he said, I will make them some beautiful boots. And so the two worked all day, and they sewed, 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 and they sewed, 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 and he tapped, 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 and he tapped, 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 and he made beautiful shoes, and she made a shirt with a vest, wonderful trousers, and they made little hats for them. And that night, before they went to sleep, they put the clothes out on the bench and went inside to their room, said their prayers, blew out the candle, got into bed, commended their souls to God, and slept all night in great peace. At midnight, exactly at midnight, the window opened, and the two little naked men came in. But instead of leather, instead of patterns to work on, they found wonderful clothes. A little green hat, a little red jacket, beautiful vest, a golden blouse, wonderful trousers with stripes, and the most beautiful boots they ever saw. They put that all on. They sang about, "Merry fellows are we, no shoemakers are we again." They opened the window, off they went, closed the window, never to be seen again. But then the husband and wife were quite happy with their life, and hadn't they been visited so grandly?
Lovely.
So what do you think of that?
Well, the mystery in that story is why the little creatures don't come back again after they have been given the clothes by the human beings.
You know, I've been thinking of that. What do you think? Well, you've got an answer for
well,
it? What do you think?
I think that's the
or
main...
Or possibility. I don't mean an answer.
Possibility in the story that in some way these are creatures from another world than the humans. They live somehow in the in-between places. They talk about that in Ireland all the time. The little men, the little women who are somehow a part of the landscape in Ireland. And then if too many businessmen come in or they do things too well, then the elves will all disappear. But here they're still going on and they're appearing. And so this is a story of these little creatures from another world who want to help human beings. Now, why did they want to help human beings?
You know, I got a feeling that shoemaker was not a master craftsman. Yet. I got a feeling that he was a very good shoemaker, very good, but not a master craftsman. And I think when they came and showed him the shoes that could be made, I'm not saying that he ever made it as well as they made them. I'm not saying that. But somehow when he looks at the shoes and he sees something else, I'm wondering, what does it mean for the shoemaker to find mastery in his work? And he makes it, he does it, he continues it, and only when the wife and he can give back the gift in another way do they go away. Maybe something's been satisfied here, and they're not needed anymore.
Well, but I also think you could say that these little elves and beings are constantly coming to help human beings. And I think whenever you're writing a poem, some of those images that are a surprise are really a gift from some of these beings. You kind of call them elves, little souls, I don't know what you call them. But they know what we're trying to do, and they try to help. And the really touching thing at the end is how poor we are in giving thanks, in giving things back to these little people.
Yeah. Yes.
And what's brilliant about this story is that the husband and wife go out and buy the little clothes, and they buy the cloth, and they buy the leather, and they make these little shoes. And then once the elves see those and they put them on, then they say, oh, we are too good now to be shoemakers anymore, and they disappear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, really, it's like a blow to the stomach when you hear that. But yet there's
why something. did you want them to keep coming every night?
Yeah, certainly.
You did?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that's wonderful to be given help by these. They never appear again. Well, why is that? Because we have something that these beings from the other world want to have. And if we're generous enough to clothe them, what it means to clothe them, I don't know. But we're generous enough to do that, then they don't have to be obedient or servants of us anymore, but they can go and do all the things in their own world. It's too mysterious, isn't it?
Yes, that's wonderful. You know, that was my favorite fairy tale as a child. It's the only one I really liked was that story. And I don't know why, but it was the fact that somewhere in the middle of something that was desperate or miserable, that this could happen, that this, what you called mystery, the magic, the absolute otherworldliness that could come in and be part of our world. I loved that. I just thought it was right that they should get dressed and leave, that it would be too greedy to want them to come all the time, but that it was so magnificent. It's almost as if the story in the center of it, when they're making the magic, that the story is there. It's being filled there. And the end is the way it should be. They came and they went. I wouldn't want them to stay because they came mysteriously and they go. And the gift, I like this thing you said, because of course the gift had to be given back. What were they? I mean, they had to give them back. They had to, first of all, find out who was giving them the gifts and then give them what they needed. All gifts are meant to be extraneous. They're all meant to be of the spirit. You can't count on them in terms of material goods. You can't say what the value is. So you get a present, and really it has a material value, but that's not the gift. The gift is that which you can't see.
Well, let's drag it back again to a theme we were having earlier. Suppose that these elves are great artists. Isn't that the implication?
Right.
Suppose that when you're doing free verse, it's okay, but the elves have not taken part in free verse.
I like this.
When you do even those sonnets that Shakespeare did, when you do all of the great tunes that people did in the Middle Ages and the Romance things, in which the forms are so intricate and so beautiful, maybe those are the things done by the elves. And the trouble with modern life is that modern poetry is that if you're doing free verse, you're not giving any gifts to the elves. And so they can't be released. I don't know what I'm saying.
No, that's not so. I know what you're saying. It's absolutely right, because the gifts that you give back are not really the clothes, but it's also the act of seeing them
and of
saying, whoa, what do they need? And
that's
the ephemeral part, the part that we can't name, the part that can't be sold.
Well, I love that whole possibility, because it suggests that art really is not finally done by the human world.
Mm-hmm.
And the form is somehow done and given by the elves. That what the artist has to do is to do it well enough so that the elves will agree to come and help.
I wanted to ask you something about the personal changes that happen when you write.
One of the first poems I published was one that begins, "Oh, in an early morning, I think I shall live forever. I am wrapped in my joyful flesh as the grass is wrapped in its clouds of green. Rising from a bed where I dreamt of long rides past castles and hot coals, the sun lies happily on my knees. I have suffered and survived the night, bathed in dark water, like any blade of grass. But the strong leaves of the box elder trees, plunging in the wind, call us to disappear into the wilds of the universe, where we shall sit at the foot of a plant and live forever like the dust." So that's kind of a sweet poem, and I still like it very much. But by trying to work now in the elaborate form that the Muslims developed, in the gazelle form, I can write about many other things besides how I feel in the morning. And I'm able to bring in things from our own history and from Islamic history. And to me, that's a little bit like bringing form in is like inviting the elves to do their part. And this is a poem from my wife, Ruth. "There's a graceful way of doing things. Birch branches curve slightly upward, or the wind brings a few snowflakes down and then joins the night, or you leave me a sprig of chervil and no more. Each morning we have this new choice. We can walk a few steps behind the others down the mountain. We can enter a conversation as if we were blessed, not insisting on our old way of gaining pity. There's a way you have of knowing what another may need ahead of time, before the party begins, as smoke sometimes disappears downward among branches. And I've learned from you this new way of letting a poem be.
Hey, ho, nobody home, no me, nor drink, nor money have I none, no yet will I be merry, no yet will I be merry.
And we always knew we'd never make any money during this kind of work. But, you know, when I heard you tell a story first, I was absolutely astounded because I had never heard stories told as an art form. When you get in the middle of a story, suddenly your voice changes and all sorts of amazing images appear in the mind because of the way your voice continues its pattern and allies itself with something in the story. So I thought that was a form of magic, and I still do.
Well, thank you, Robert, for that conversation. And thank you for the poems and your thoughts on story and poems. You know, we said at the beginning, I mentioned si conta si racconta, it is told and retold, and we start our stories that way. Once upon a time, it happened. Once, si conta si racconta, it's told and retold. And we end with, and they lived happily ever after. Remember, friends, our ancestors were not so cruel as to tell us that we were going to live happily ever after. What delusion that would have brought. And as a matter of fact, it has. People have misunderstood that. They lived happily ever after. We? No. We are here looking for our good work. That's how my great-grandmother, who was a storyteller from my town, that's how she ended. So these frames are important in the old folk tales because they tell us that time has stopped still in them. These are not characters. These are people we can slip into. These are archetypes. These are great beings like the grandmother, the one who knows trouble because she knows life and she can pick and pluck the child up, the boy or the girl in trouble. She can take care of it, put them in her pocket. And so these great archetypes live within that eternal world while we, friends, we have to say goodbye. And I wish you, with that hey-ho, no meat nor drink, nor money have I none, and yet we will be merry. And I wish you the many joys and gifts of winter.
Told and Retold was produced by Joya Timpanelli and Sarah Montague and directed by Sarah Montague. Recorded and mixed by Bruce Berkey at Nevesa Production, Woodstock, New York, and at the Clubhouse, Rhinebeck, New York. Readings by Eric Darton and Kate Barnes. Mellstock Lane vocal by Brad Crusswell. Additional vocals by Bob Dylan, Billie Holiday, Susan Osborne, and Tom Waits. Special guest, Robert Bly. Theme music composed by Artie Trom. Featured music by Happy and Artie Trom, Gilles Malkin, and Jacques Lussier. Told and Retold was produced with the support of Tour Ghoul. Special thanks to Epi Convell and Allison Granusi.
Our Robert Bly interview was recorded by Gil Schuster.
Many people use the month of December to make annual contributions to charities and nonprofits. If you're among them, consider the value you receive from WILL. Consider how WILL helps you stay informed and keeps you entertained. Then, please consider making a tax-deductible contribution before December 31st. Make your gift online at our secure website, willpledge.org. And thanks.
Support comes from Meyer Drapery Services. Specializing in custom draperies since 1972, Meyer Drapery offers more than 1 million linear yards of drapery material in their two local wholesale warehouses and retail outlet at 330 North Neal in downtown Champaign. Installation and design services are also available.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.